Hello, and welcome to Minding Kingston's podcast, where we talk about all things mental health with people who live or work in the borough. I'm Vicky Bourne, and I work as the charity's counselling and wellbeing manager. In this edition,
I think the thing with acting is that, and with things like anxiety, you focus a lot on the things you can't control, which is why it makes this industry really hard for people with anxiety like me who can't control it, and yet I'm doing it anyway, when all I want to do is be able to control everything in my life. Then I think in my mind, my kind of false belief is that if I can control everything, I'll be happy.
Shannon Hayes is an actor who has appeared in big name TV dramas as well as many stage productions. She spoke to me about her challenges at school and at Oxford University and beyond, where she struggled with anxiety, bereavement and body dysmorphic disorder. I started by asking her about her recent successful run at the Rose Theatre in Kingston, where alongside Neve Cusack, she starred in The Seven Pomegranate Seeds. I wondered what it was like to return to acting after lockdown.
Yeah, so I did a play before this one at the start of when theatres were opening again. So I was at Hampstead. So it was not the first time I'd been in after the pandemic, but definitely the first time I'd been in that bigger space after the pandemic, because I did Hampstead downstairs, which was so much smaller. So it was nice to see the audience again, because when I did it at Hampstead, it was so soon after lockdown that the audience members would run away before I came out. So I never got a chance to see what they felt. And it was really strange. It felt like I was doing a show and then never getting to see the effect that it had on people. Whereas this time I got to see people afterwards. So that was lovely. And it was my first time at the Rose, and I'd never been even to watch shows. So this was lovely to go to a theatre that I'd never, ever been before and to finally get an audience response. So I had a great time. And it was Neve's first play back from the pandemic. So it was great to be a part of that with her too.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. So many congratulations on that. So your acting career began during your time at Oxford University, but you're originally from a single parent family in Lewisham, and that sounds like quite a journey.
Yeah, hugely. My mum didn't go to uni, and my dad, who I don't speak to, but he didn't go to uni either. That's how much I know. So I was the first person in my immediate family to go to university. So yeah, to go to Oxford was definitely unusual, but my granddad was very happy. My granddad's from Nigeria, and his greatest ambition was to study, and he never got to do that. That's his biggest regret. And so doing that made him very proud. And I always wanted to go for myself. It wasn't really, my family didn't force me to go. It wasn't like if I didn't go to uni, I'd be cast out. It was just something that I always wanted to do. And I had Oxford in my sights. I don't really know why, but I wanted to go from when I was about 12 years old. I have no reasoning as to why. I didn't even think I knew that it was, you know, the best. I don't think I knew that. I just wanted to go there. And so I spent most of my teenage years trying to get there, which was strange, because then when I got there, I didn't know. I thought that would, I guess, fix everything. I had a lot of problems in school. I never felt like I fitted in my secondary school or sixth form. And so I thought going to Oxford would fix that, and it didn't. So that was the beginning of me unpacking a lot of the things that I'd been dealing with in my adolescence.
Okay, do you want to say a little bit about that?
So I think, I went to, my primary school was great. I then went to year seven. I did a lot of sports. But when I went into year seven, I ended up going, unbeknownst to my mom, attending a state school that was one of the roughest schools in the area. She thought it was great for sports, and we all thought it was great for sports. But in actual fact, there was little sports that went on, and it was just a really rough school. And so that was really shocking to me. And I didn't really know what to do, because I'd gone into year seven thinking it was going to be a great time and I'd do lots of football, and then ended up feeling really anxious, uncomfortable, and basically didn't have like any friends. I used to walk around the school playground by myself at lunchtimes. And so it got quite bad. And then in the end, I came out of school and ended up going to a really small private school where I'm from in Southeast London. And it was a really tiny school. In my whole year, there were like 23 people. It was one of those schools a lot of people who didn't get on in other schools went to, which created a really kind of varied, bit of a strange year group, because we'd all sort of fallen out of other schools and ended up in this school. And obviously my mum is on her own, and has done, you know, sort of admin her whole life. So it was quite a stretch to afford private schools. So we went on bursaries and scholarships, but she struggled for a really long time to pay the fees. And so school for me was just difficult. I went from one school to another trying to fit in. So again, I just spent a lot of time being on my own, which is coincidentally why I think I ended up acting, because I spent so much time on my own in school and I'm an only child that all I did was kind of play by myself, I guess, write stories by myself. So there's a lot of time to kind of, you know, indulge in the imagination. So that's kind of how my school career began. And then once I started in private schools, I sort of ended up staying there. So I went to sixth form, again, to a private school on scholarship, full scholarship this time. So my mum didn't have to struggle anymore. But I was the only black girl, one of two black girls in my entire year in a school in Battersea, which is really far from where I live.
And that must have been really difficult, I imagine.
Yeah, really. And especially because I guess I didn't know what effect that would have when I went. So I didn't think, oh, I'm worried that I'm only one of two black girls. I mean, obviously I didn't know, but I never thought, I know some people would already be worried about that. I didn't ever have that worry. So I just went thinking it would be fine. But actually, a lot of my experiences now, I realise, is because of that cultural divide and microaggressions. Because it wasn't like anyone was outwardly racist to me. But in a way, that's sort of harder because it's hard to explain.
It's a subtle institutionalised racism that exists in these places.
I remember I went to the head of year at that school and it said that I was struggling to fit in, wasn't having a good time there. And she said, well, it's probably because you came from a state school where you were the smartest and now you've come to this school and it's more of a challenge, which was wrong because I didn't come from a state school, first of all. And second of all, it wasn't because I was finding it academically challenging. It was because I didn't feel like it was set up to accommodate someone from my background. So it was things like that made it really, really difficult for me at school. And I guess I didn't have all the language that we have now to know what was happening or what was going on. So it meant that I just felt like I was the problem and I didn't really, you know, I wasn't confident enough or, yeah, I wasn't bold enough to make new friends, which led to a lot of anxiety.
An experience echoed by a lot of people, I imagine. And from there, obviously, onto the very rarefied and very white atmosphere of Oxford too.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was strange because by that point, I guess that's what I expected then. So when I went to Oxford, which was a really, I guess, which is why it was particularly unique for me, I think, because a lot of the other black people and people of colour that would join clubs like the African and Caribbean Society, for them, a lot of them, it was very new to be in a space where they were the only white person on their course, black person on their course. But for me, it wasn't. So when I went to Oxford, I was so happy to see like two other black girls. I was like, oh my God, there's three. For me, that was a huge deal. So it was interesting.
Step forward.
Yeah, I didn't have, even though it's not, obviously, comparatively, there should be way more. But for me, coming from the school that I came from, it was shocking to see more than one other black girl. So I didn't have the same initial shock. So I kind of felt like I was between two groups. I didn't really fit into the African Caribbean Society because I didn't have a lot of friends that were even black at that point or people of colour because I'd gone to schools so outside of my area and my comfort zone. But then equally, I obviously didn't fit in with a lot of the kind of middle class, upper middle class white people in Oxford. So I kind of was in flux between two groups and didn't know where I belonged because of my experiences before going to Oxford.
Sure. And you started acting there, I gather.
Acting was a thing that I did on the side from when I was about 14. I went to this part-time drama school called Identity Drama School, which now is got a much bigger name. People like John Boyega, Letitia Wright, Malachi Kirby.
Wow.
Yeah. Were all in the years above me, but and weren't even who they are now. It's so funny now. Yeah, they were just, you know,
the average student.
Yeah, the average student. And so I went there and that was the first time I did acting. It was the first, the first drama school, part-time drama school for people of colour. Now it's changed, it's diversified, but obviously it started a lot of the careers of a lot of black actors and actresses. So that was the first time I'd done drama with people that looked like me, because when I did drama before, it was all musical theatre and stage kids and not a lot of people of colour. And so that was the first time when I was 14 that I realised that I could do it. And then I just started writing to agents by myself. I don't know why I thought I was good enough. No one, I just started writing to agents. And from there it kind of built. But when I got my first agent, I didn't get anywhere with auditions for a whole year. I didn't get any recalls. I didn't get any jobs. I wasn't ready, but it gave me a good, I think, exposure to the industry, even if I wasn't ready to go and do jobs. It gave me kind
Got to get used to that rejection early on.
And just auditioning, it's such a strange...
Of course. Putting yourself out there and taking those risks.
Exactly. So it was really great. And then by the time I went to Oxford, I switched agents because I took a break and realised that it wasn't going well. Ended up doing an open call. Got a different agent from an open call audition, which is like an audition that, you know, you just sort of apply and then you get invited and then sort of anyone can go. And then they selected me from that. And then, yeah, I got my first professional job in the summer of my first year of uni.
So, and still managed to pass your degree after all that going on as well.
Yeah, I passed my degree. I got a 2-1. We made it.
Yeah, so a lot going on for you at that time.
Yeah, massively. And I think that a lot, I was still... I guess I've always had issues with anxiety, and I think that was still at its height at Oxford. And only now, when I reflect on it, do I realise that I maybe wasn't as secure as I thought I was during that period of time, on hindsight, which is also what led to what happened at drama school, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But
No, tell me a bit about that.
So I think... At Oxford, yeah, I was doing a lot of things, as we've discovered. I was doing, yes. I think acting became an escape, as it is for a lot of people. But for me, it was like my, I guess in my head, I wanted to really get a job so that I could leave Oxford. That was my motivation. I can get a job and then I can leave early.
Yeah, it's a way out.
Yeah, and it wasn't because... I guess it just, I thought I going to Oxford, as I said in the beginning, would be the place that I felt at home in, because people had told me before going to Oxford, you know, you can get there, you've got good grades, everyone there will have good grades, they'll be just like you. So I thought I'd go there and finally find my tribe.
Yeah, which is a fantasy I think a lot of people have about university, isn't it?
Exactly. You know. You go there and you know, you find your people, and I didn't, obviously. So it meant that I... didn't know what to do next, because that's what I put everything into. I didn't have either African Caribbean Society. I then didn't feel like I fully fitted in there. So I didn't have any kind of, my identity was, I guess, split. And so, it was just a very difficult time for me. And then when I went to drama school, I went straight after Oxford. I didn't take a break. I went straight after when I finished that year and graduated. That summer I had off, and then October I started Bristol. So I was applying to drama schools in my last year, again, not taking a time to kind of break, pause, rebalance. So I went straight into drama school. Bristol was great. It actually is one of the most diverse schools, I believe. In my year of only 14 people, I'd say about a quarter were people of colour. And in the year below, it was like a 50-50 split.
Comparatively speaking.
Yeah. So that was great. It was mainly just all of the feelings that I hadn't, I guess, dealt with mentally, like my anxiety. I have always, now it's kind of not as big a deal, but I suffer with body dysmorphic disorder, which basically is like anorexia, but to do with how you feel that you look physically, as in terms of like your facial features. So growing up, for me, I had a problem with my nose. I wanted to have a nose job. I always felt like that was the thing that was stopping me from having friends. It was because I wasn't attractive enough and I didn't look like the blonde girls, or, you know. And so going to Bristol in a drama school where, you know, there are so many eurocentrically attractive people, because that's a lot of the time what they pick. And in the industry, that's what people favour.
Of course.
Was really hard. Really hard. And it kind of created a lot of those feelings that I had, but in a very intense and heightened environment. And so, again, I just started the comparison, feeling like I wasn't good enough, all of those feelings. And it just got kind of worse and worse. And then my aunt passed away, who is basically my best friend, passed away at the end of my first year of Bristol. And that sort of started the beginnings of what is now quite a big problem, which is my anxiety. It just unlocked a lot of feelings that I was suppressing, I guess. So intense anxiety suddenly came to the forefront, intermixed with grief, and I ended up dropping out after my first year because I just couldn't be back in that intense environment in the second year. Once I'd left and gone home after the first year,
couldn't face going back.
Yeah, I'd come off of the treadmill. I'd spent so long going to Oxford and then doing drama and then doing auditions and then going to drama school, and then all of a sudden it ended. And after that first year, and I just couldn't find the energy to
continue.
Yeah. I like physically couldn't. And then I started therapy. So that was the beginning of my journey into realizing what was going on mentally.
And tell us a bit about that. That sounds like that worked well for you, Shannon. Was that a positive experience?
It was, actually. So I did therapy on the NHS intermittently from when I was younger, when I had body dysmorphic disorder, and it was really bad. So this was the point where I couldn't really leave the house sometimes because I'd feel so unattractive that I didn't think I could socialize. I'd spend half of my day taking selfies and constantly checking my appearance from every angle, every reflection, every mirror.
Because, of course, you were thinking about entering a profession where you're really putting yourself out there, weren't you, as well as people have.
Exactly. It makes it even worse because you are partially
under scrutiny,
judged by that. Yeah. And my agents would say things like that. And it would make, you know, it would sort of make it even worse. But so I had therapy sort of for that kind of. I'd have one session and then I wouldn't go back because it was quite, first of all, it'd take a long time to do it on the NHS. I love the NHS, but it does take a long time, yeah, therapy-wise.
There are long waiting lists, that's reality.
Long waiting lists. And so I never got the chance to really unpack anything really before I'd end up having to leave or going to uni or whatever. So leaving Bristol was the first time that I was going to try and do it privately because I was back at home. I saved up some money from jobs. I obviously wasn't paying rent because I was living at home. So I did it myself and I went privately. And it was great. I did it for maybe a couple of months, just in my area while I was doing pretty much nothing else because I dropped out of school. And it was a good experience because it was the only time, it was kind of before the pandemic, but it was like, for me, it was my own version of a pandemic where I was just completely doing nothing but going to therapy and coming home. And it was great because it meant that I got to the space and time outside of acting to process what was, and outside of academics to process what was going on and to detach my self-worth from academics and getting an acting job. Those are the two things that I'd realised had become everything to me. If I didn't get a job, then I wasn't good enough and I was ugly again and all those negative feelings would come back. So I had to undo that.
Yes, unpack your worth from those two criteria, really. Yes. So how did you then re-enter the world of acting?
So I'd say I had about 2-3 months where I wasn't doing any acting. I was still auditioning, not ad hoc. And then I think I got this TV job. I got a part in Years and Years. Small part,
which was an amazing series.
I'm so happy.
A couple of years ago now, I think, wasn't it?
So the casting director for that actually started my career, Andy Pryor. He started my TV career and he gave me a part in that, so I owe a lot to Andy. But he gave me a part in that, and that kind of was, I think, if I'm right, the first thing that I did after Bristol. So that kind of, you know, just
thanks. Absolutely, what a break.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. So that was good because it was, you know, it wasn't like a 6-month job or anything for me. So it was a good way to get back in. And then slowly I've kind of done more and more and I've done more plays. So I think really for me, therapy was, I guess, the turning point. It still took, you know, some months after that to stop that feeling of not when you're not working.
Of course.
I mean, I still have that feeling now of not feeling like you're, you know, you're kind of,
I mean, it's characterized by unstable employment and the unforgiving audition processes and obviously, as you've talked about, the constant pressure to be your best and all of those things can take their toll, can't they, and make it really difficult to prioritize looking after your mental health.
Exactly. And me and my friend who went to the same drama school, and we're signed to the same agent, but we talk about this all the time. We both did therapy at the same time, and it's important to, and he did academics before me, so there's a lot of parallels. I think it's important to find what you can control. I think the thing with acting is that, and with things like anxiety, you focus a lot on the things you can't control, which is why it makes this industry really hard for people with anxiety like me, who can't control it, and yet I'm doing it anyway, when all I want to do is be able to control everything in my life. Then I think in my mind, my kind of false belief is that if I can control everything, I'll be happy. But obviously that's not true.
That's not possible for any of us, really, is it? It's all about acceptance for what we can't control, largely, isn't it?
But exactly.
Anecdotally, at least, there does seem to be a connection between the pressures of the profession and conditions such as depression and anxiety. And maybe part of that is about being in contact with your emotions all the time as an actor, which makes it difficult to then cut off from them and not let them take over.
Yeah, I guess. I think it's something that I guess, for me, yeah, I'm thinking about what it is or why, you know, some people see acting as therapy, which is good, but can be dangerous. So it's great to have like a facility to explore your emotions, which is great. And it's a positive thing to do it through acting. But again, what you just said, if you're using it as a way to deal with, so obviously my aunt passed away, if I was to have done something to do with grief then and there, it would have been a great way to I guess confront those emotions, but also potentially the worst thing I could have done, because I was spending my whole life outside of acting suppressing those feelings, that if I was to do, you know, a monologue about losing someone I love, it probably would have all come out then. So I think with that, there has to be a kind of a balance, and I guess I'm figuring out what those boundaries are and how to work safely. Because I think before, in the beginning, I used to use, and I would say do use a lot of those real emotions when I'm doing those sorts of scenes, which I think, I mean, has its positives and negatives. I think I'm learning that you can't always, you know, I'd always make it really real for me each. Yeah. So I did a play at Oxford, it was Constellations by Nick Payne, which was done again recently.
Yes, it was.
But there's a final monologue about, you know, if they do break up, or that person dies and they break up because that person, the one person in the relationship has died, that they'll still have all of their time, because she's a scientist and she believes that, you know, they're living in parallel universes. So even if she dies in this world, their love will still exist in other worlds. And every night I think of my aunt, who hadn't passed away then, but I guess in my mind I was almost preparing myself for that reality. And okay, it probably made a great performance, but I think it's not always good to use something so real to you if you don't have a way of switching it off, which I guess I don't have a way of switching off, is the honest question. I guess those feelings, I don't have a way of, like, some people go home and they listen to music or they listen to a certain song and it gets them out of it, but I guess I haven't found what my switch is yet.
Yeah. Yeah, because constantly having to access those very sad emotions, which is something that, you know, for the majority of people, they don't have to do, obviously can have that kind of effect, can't it? So do you have anyone you particularly admire in the entertainment industry who you feel is paving the way in the discussion on mental health?
I don't know if I know many from other actors that come to mind, but I know there are a lot of just celebrities in general, especially now, that are people that I wouldn't even expect, people from reality TV shows that are really doing their best to use their platform and speak positively about mental health. So I know there's a guy from Love Island, what's his name? Dr. Alex, yeah. So
he's
done
fantastic, isn't he?
Great work, yeah. And I think what's great about these reality stars is that they reach so many people because they have insane followings, more sort of greater than a lot of actors. So I think it's great that instead of selling bikinis and, you know, self tanning products, they're actually,
yeah, talking about the stresses,
the real side. Yeah,
yeah, it's, and, absolutely.
And I think it's such a, and it's really important. So I think people think that reality TV is, you know, a really, and being an influencer is all great, which it is, and you get a lot of good perks, but it, I mean, obviously it isn't, and they still have their normal lives, and it goes to show that even if you have got everything that you wanted, there are still very, very real stresses.
Of course. And we don't all live those Instagram lives that some people like to promote. So you've appeared in incredibly successful TV programmes, as you just mentioned, and amongst others, there's Cold Feet and also Ted Lasso. I wonder what was next on your agenda and what direction you'd like your career to be taking now. Obviously, it's early days for you.
Early days, yeah. I feel like I'm just finally getting my flow with plays. I wanted to do more plays a year ago, and I think I'm doing that. So that's been great. But TV is where I started, and it's always what I tend to return to. And I guess in the future, that's what I see more and more TV. I'd love to go to America. New York is my goal. I love New York. I fell in love with it when I was 21, and I'd love to go back there. Right now, I'm on the audition mill, as you always are. You know, you go from job and then you go straight back to auditions. So I'm not sure what's next concretely, but I'd love to do some more TV. That would be great. I'd love to work with Niamh again. Niamh, we'd love that.
She's amazing, isn't she?
Yeah, love that. Such a good time with her.
Something we like to ask all our podcast guests is somewhere where they would recommend in London where they like to go and relax, perhaps for a walk or a space to think. Obviously, you spent a bit of time working around the Kingston area, and I think Ted Lasso was also shot in Richmond,
Yeah.
I haven't managed to see it yet because it's on an obscure channel, but I love football, and I really hope to be able to access it somehow or other.
Yeah, definitely. Richmond, it was beautiful. So, yeah, when I filmed Ted Lasso, every time I've come there, I've been blown away. I think they actually... I'm not sure where in Richmond it is, but they put a tree in the town centre or sort of that wasn't there before, and I thought the whole time that the landscape existed outside of Ted Lasso, and it doesn't. It's fake trees, which is amazing.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so definitely watch it, and you'll probably be able to tell me where it is. I don't know, but it's so lovely. I love Richmond Park actually, so if I lived closer, I'd be walking in Richmond Park all the time. I guess for people that don't live in Southwest London, I recommend. So now I live in Shoreditch, East London, and I love
another fantastic area.
Yeah, I love walking along Columbia Road. I would recommend that.
I was talking there to the actor Shannon Hayes. Before we go, do have a listen out for the other chats in this series. You can find them wherever you usually download your podcasts. And we'd be grateful if you subscribe and left a review too. It really helps to spread the word. I'm Vicky Bourne of Mind in Kingston. And until the next time, take good care.